From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. And we start with another record. Here in the U.S., 11 million people have now tested positive for the coronavirus. And the drug company Moderna says, based on early data, its COVID-19 vaccine is 95% effective. In a few minutes, we'll take a look at that vaccine, which experts say won't be widely available for months.
But Dr. Anthony Fauci was asked on NBC's Today Show about the importance of a presidential transition for the approval and distribution of the vaccine.
We want to get doses to people starting in December, and then we want to really get the ball rolling as we get into January, February, and March. We want a smooth process for that. And the way you do that is by essentially having the two groups speak to each other and exchange information.
And Fauci also said he was concerned that the Trump administration is still standing in the way of the Biden transition. So let's bring in NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Hi, Mara.
Hi, Robin.
And as you know, President Trump tweeted today that the positive vaccine results, quote, took place on my watch. Now, it's true, he did launch Operation Warp Speed, the vaccine effort. On the other hand, his advisor, Scott Atlas, tweeted out that people in Michigan should rise up against restrictions. Now, Michigan's Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer announced new restrictions on Sunday after a spike in COVID cases there. But rise up against a governor who's been threatened. Thoughts?
You know, it's true that Donald Trump has focused on the vaccine. That's absolutely correct. But he hasn't been that involved in efforts to mitigate the virus. And what you've got is this really clashing set of messages. Scott Atlas telling people in Michigan to rise up against restrictions. Of course, that reminded everyone of President Trump's calls to, quote, liberate Michigan after some far-right protesters showed up at the state capitol with automatic weapons, semi-automatic weapons, and that was even before the kidnapping plot against the governor. Meanwhile, you have Jerome Adams, who's the Surgeon General, telling people to, quote, be a patriot and wear a mask. So it's been unclear all along where the Trump administration comes down on this, but once again, two different messages. One, we should mitigate, we should wear masks and socially distance. The other, we should rise up against all the restrictions.
Dangerous. Look, the General Services Administration has refused to sign off on the Biden transition. President-elect Biden's incoming chief of staff, Ron Klain, told NBC's Meet the Press he wants to see that change this week so that Biden can get necessary resources and briefings. Do you think that's going to happen?
Well, I don't think it's going to happen until President Trump tells the GSA to do it. Ron Klain said that if the GSA would issue that formal statement allowing the resources to go to the Biden transition team, then Biden's team could meet with public health officials and receive intelligence briefings. And that's what the Biden camp wants. I just don't see it happening until President Trump wants it to happen. And when the GSA does that, that is a type of formal recognition that Joe Biden is the president-elect. And that's not, President Trump just isn't there yet.
Yeah, right. Well, I'm wondering how many Republicans are there. Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson told NBC over the weekend he wants to see a smooth transition. But Republicans, by and large, are not standing up to the president, again, who claims without any evidence that the election was stolen and that he won. How long can they go on aiding and abetting? Yeah,
I think they can go on for quite a while. There are some official steps that will happen. The Electoral College will meet. But don't forget, Republicans don't want to cross the president before the January 5th special elections in Georgia because they don't want him to do anything that could jeopardize the chances of the two Republicans who are running there. So right now, Republicans are doing what they've done for the last 4 years, which is biting their tongue. Several of them have said Biden should get intelligence briefings, but for the most part, they are not standing up to the president.
Well, could it also be, I mean, there is that election, although some would say it's harder to make the case that Republicans need to turn out to keep the Senate if you're also saying that Biden isn't going to be the president. But what do you
That's
make of
too logical.
That, I mean, just, we only had a couple seconds, but the president had that huge turnout. So perhaps Republicans are looking at that as well, the supporters.
Yes, they need him to help get their voters out in Georgia. Absolutely. And if it doesn't make sense what they're saying, they don't mind.
NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson. Thank you, Mara.
You're welcome.
A second potential vaccine against COVID-19 is now in the mix. The biotech company Moderna announced its coronavirus vaccine is more than 94% effective, according to early data in its clinical trial. A week ago, Pfizer and BioNTech said their vaccine was more than 90% effective. This is encouraging news, but a vaccine still won't be widely available for many months. And the pandemic is getting worse. 1 million people in the United States contracted the virus last week, bringing the total to 11 million cases since the pandemic began. Dr. Gregory Polin, director of the Mayo Clinic's Vaccine Research Group, joins us now. And doctor, thank you for being here.
My pleasure. How are you, Tanya?
I am well. Thank you so much for asking. So we should point out that this is preliminary data from Moderna, and the results haven't been validated by outside experts yet. But a vaccine that's more than 94% effective is really encouraging. What's your reaction to this news?
You know, you're exactly right, Tanya. One, the proviso that all we have is a press release. We haven't actually seen peer-reviewed data yet. And as a physician and scientist, you always want to temper your enthusiasm with that. On the other hand, for a COVID-weary world, this looks like a home run. To have a vaccine 95% effective is a big deal in the world of vaccinology.
This vaccine by Moderna and the one by Pfizer are both messenger RNA vaccines. Can you explain how they work?
So what we do is you take the genetic code that produces the S or spike protein in your cell. Your cell then displays that on the surface, and your circulating immune cells see that and react to it as if it was the whole virus. So you're tricking, if you will, your immune system into thinking that it's seeing the virus, produces antibodies that neutralize the virus when you get exposed to it, and produces cellular immunity. Now, what we don't know whether this vaccine prevents asymptomatic infection, transmission, death. We don't know those things yet. And one important point that I think most every scientist has missed, these are being tested in locations around the world where, for the most part, people are wearing masks and distancing, maybe not in parts of the U.S., but elsewhere in the world. And so the efficacy measures that we have are, if you will, vaccine plus mask plus social distancing. Mm-hmm. What happens when it's vaccine alone? That's something that we'll see and understand over time.
Moderna says its vaccine can be stored at temperatures of a standard home or medical refrigerator, as opposed to Pfizer's, which requires a much colder storage temp. How significant is this in the race for a vaccine?
I'm glad you asked that, Tanya, because it's actually a critical question. And being able to store it for 30 days at refrigeration-type temperatures is a game changer, because it means you can deploy this vaccine anywhere in the world. When you need minus 75 degrees, and that's centigrade, by the way, you're now talking about limiting vaccine distribution to major medical centers in the West. Doctors' offices don't have that. Pharmacists don't have that. Whole nations don't have that.
Yeah. If this holds up, what is the likely timeline for approval and distribution?
I think what's likely to happen, and what the company has said, is that they're going to seek emergency use authorization. My guess is we'll see movement on this before the end of the year, but widespread availability of the vaccine really not until the second and maybe even into the third quarter of 21.
And doctor, because we want to think this far ahead, can you give us some perspective on how long it would take for a vaccine to actually end this pandemic?
Assuming, this is a big assumption, assuming that the virus doesn't mutate and assuming that the American public would take the vaccine and continue to wear masks, we could end this actually sometime in the second to third quarter of 21, certainly before the fall of 21. I'm being cautious in saying if and emphasizing my words, because thus far, it's been very difficult to convince Americans that this is an important disease. It causes considerable morbidity and mortality. It causes a surge demand unlike anything we have seen on hospitals and medical care systems. And that's the only way we're going to beat this thing back is by wearing masks, distancing, and a high quality, long durability vaccine.
Right. There's not one solution in a vaccine. You're really bringing home the point that we also have to continue our habits of wearing masks and social distancing.
You're very right. I mean, we can develop, and we do, we develop vaccines that are safe and effective. The one thing, of course, that we can't control is human behavior.
Dr. Gregory Polin is director of the Mayo Clinic's Vaccine Research Group. Dr. Polin, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Be safe.
Nearly a quarter of the children under 18 living in America live in a single-parent home, according to a Pew Research Center report. How are single parents faring? Single-income homes already struggling may now suddenly be without that sole income, without the safety net of other family members who can't risk helping with childcare. We're going to hear from a single father of quadruplets in a moment, but first, a nonprofit that helped him and other single parents in the Texas area with resources and community. Single Parent Advocate was founded by Stacy Poitras, a single mom herself. And Stacy, we know single parents can feel shame, feel like they're the only ones not making it. You say what?
First of all, you're not alone. And no, you're not alone. There's 5 D's I always talk about. Death of a spouse, divorce, disease, disability, or sometimes there's a decision that's been made to keep a child. Those types of situations set us up in an economy that really is not designed for a single head of household raising 2 or more children on their own. And we together have the responsibility to figure out, you know, how are we going to make it possible for these families to thrive?
You said there's an economic bias, there's a cultural bias. There are groups for single parents. It sounds like you're saying, find those people.
Absolutely. You know, I'll tell you how I started Single Parent Advocate. I was a single mom, and in 08, 09, whenever the market fell through, I got displaced. And so I went around looking for assistance. And I called 211, and they said, well, we might could give you $14 worth of food stamps, but if you're not pregnant, I'm not going to be able to get you any kind of health coverage. And it just made the hair on the back of my neck stand up. I just felt the burning desire in my heart to not leave that place without changing it for others. I felt led to create a Bible study in my church for single parents. That was the impetus behind a Single Parent Advocate. Once I birthed that name, it was like I was complete.
And I know your organization is behind things like tuition assistance, teaching job skills, flexible work hours. I mean, talk about that.
Yes. There was an RN that works at an area hospital, and she was throwing her hands up one day, and she said, I feel punished for working. I feel punished for being the one who gets up and goes to work and leaves my kids at school, and I'm probably the last one to pick them up. Like, if 1 in 3 kids are being raised by a single parent in North Texas, 1 in 4 in the U.S., if we know it takes $48,000 and change to raise 2 kids on your own in North Texas, there's not enough jobs out there that pay enough for that size of the population to succeed without assistance. Yeah.
And it strikes me that whatever infrastructure a single parent builds, you know, people that can help them, a boss that might give them flexible hours, a lot of that's gone right now. If you're taking COVID seriously, you're not hanging out with other people. Maybe your kids aren't in school, and so you're staying home.
There has been a lot of job loss, families being food poor, worrying about paying rent and utilities. I've had families asking for assistance for auto repair, books to stay in college online. I've had one single mother tell me that she needed help paying her physician's copay. She has cancer. I would say to the single parents out there, raise your hand. Pick up the phone and call someone. We tend to hide our struggle from the counselors and the powers that be at schools, because we don't want to set off any red flags that, you know, you're not the best parent, especially single fathers.
Because they're embarrassed?
Yeah. Do you remember when the deadbeat dad was like a big buzzword? If you're a single father, you know, you're still kind of put in that category. I would just say sometimes single parents feel like they're wearing out their community. It feels like you're asking for too much help. We've got to change how we see this population. It's got to happen.
That's Stacey Poythress, founder of Single Parent Advocate, a nonprofit organization providing resources to single parents in northern Texas. We'll link you up at hereandnow.org. Stacey, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, let's bring in Chai Mack, also of Texas. He's gotten help from Stacey's group. Chai is a single parent of quadruplets. Their mom, his wife, died during their birth. 8 years later, he's now focused on raising them. He says he's struggling but succeeding. He also says he agrees. He's often looked at as a deadbeat because it's hard to hold a well-paying job with the demands of parenting. He'd stopped full-time work before the pandemic. Since then, he's struggled to find part-time work. Currently, he delivers dry cleaning. And Chai, you say men especially, when you reach out to them, tell you to just find a good woman to help you do this?
Right. So two of my kids are girls and they have some girl problems sometimes that I don't understand. And when I bring up some of those in passing, they really think, oh, the solution is you just need to find yourself a good wife.
Yeah. You're doing this alone.
Yes, I am alone. And there's no good cop or bad cop. There's no one to bounce ideas off of. When I reach out for help, there's some shame. And there's a lot of no's as well. Stacey's organization is one of the few that I found that that appealed to both genders.
You've also said that as a man, there's something maybe unmanly about it. Your focus should be on furthering your career.
Correct. So some of the jobs that I've had, when there's extra hours, they just assume that I have a wife to unload the children onto. And I can't really speak up because I'm afraid of losing the job. When I used to be a software coder, they would just be discouraged to let me join the project because they think that I'll have problems finding childcare if they knew that I was a single dad. So I don't dare let people know at work. And so there's no pictures of my kids, nothing.
Oh, that's terrible. And yet you're saying what a lot of moms, by the way, whether or not they're single moms, they feel that way, that they don't want to signal that they have children because they might not be considered for a career path. It sounds like you're saying, you know, maybe I don't even want to take those extra hours. I want to prioritize my kids at times. And that should be rewarded or understood as well.
Correct. And I don't want to be placed in a position where I have to choose.
Right. Right.
It's definitely set up for women, the single parent world, at least in here in Texas, like the immunization forms. If you look at how a typical form, if you find it online, it always asks for the mother's maiden name. And if I enter in my name and linked with my social security number, it kicks it back because of the gender.
Well, you say this is also true. And when you try to get financial aid, the system sometimes doesn't recognize you in many ways. And by the way, during the pandemic, how do your 4-8-year-old, you know, feel about your financial struggle?
They know everything about what's happening. I mean, they see me couponing and making decisions at the grocery store. They know when I put away the Ferrero Rochers, it means I didn't make enough money that month because they know that's my favorite candy. They also see that I can do it, but I think I'm doing okay.
I know they're getting sort of a hybrid schooling right now, some remote and some in. How else is the pandemic affecting single parenting? Just about every family, you're cut off from other relatives because of the risk. How else is this affecting you?
The most immediate thing I see is the decreased opportunities for low-end work. So I it's real hard for me to find work. Retail, delivery driver, babysitting, even like cleaning houses. They tend to favor female because they're a lot safer. Mm. So there's no time for myself. I know everyone always talks about self-care. So it always seems what gets sacrificed because it's the one thing that does give. So it's been hard, less sleep. It's stressful even talking to you right now. Or when will the kids pop in?
How much in this moment has Single Parent Advocate, Stacy's organization, helped?
They've provided some family activities for us. They celebrated Father's Day, and that was a great rally cry for the dads, because just the way it falls outside of the school, we're never celebrated. So my kids finally got to celebrate a Father's Day this year. We pulled up, everyone cheered for us, they gave us gifts, they got masks, which are always in need because they lose it. So yeah, I really felt, you know, that she heard me. Last year, she handled my Christmas. She got gifts for us. I mean, I had to wrap it, but at least there was something under the tree.
Yeah. And it sounds like a lifeline.
It is.
And I understand that when you are, you know, delivering dry cleaning,
yes,
your quadruplets are in the car doing online schooling?
Correct. I have a mobile Wi-Fi in my car. And for about an hour and a half to 2 hours, I make deliveries trying to make income while my kids are in the car connected to school.
Well, but at least you're doing it all together.
Yes, but man, the noise level and the complaint, yeah, it's something. It's like your whole household, nowhere to hide. You're just stuck in that little car, you know, and I've got Google Map as loud as I can to so I don't miss my turn. I got to get it done within the hour because that's the contract.
Wow. Well, Chai, I applaud you and thank you so much.
Thank you.
And best of luck to you.
Thank you.
And best of luck to all single parents out there.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Tuesday, November 17th from noon to 1 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
Support for this podcast comes from the Boston Foundation. A resilient city and region relies on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve Greater Boston's most serious problems, from the hardships of COVID to the fight for racial equity and other important issues that affect the lives of everyone in our community. Learn how you can help build a Greater Boston that works for everyone by partnering with the Boston Foundation at tbf.org/partner.
Today, the Trump campaign withdrew a request in a lawsuit in Pennsylvania, no longer asking for hundreds of thousands of mail-in ballots to be thrown out because they were processed without campaign representatives present, was the claim. The lawsuit still says many ballots were improperly processed. The Trump campaign has lost nearly all of its legal challenges to the election results. Let's bring in Dahlia Lithwick, who writes about the courts and the law for Slate and hosts the podcast Amicus, to see where we are. Dahlia, for those, and there are those, keeping score, is it something like 1 in 19 and how many they've lost?
Hi, Robin. I think it depends on how you count. The number I'm seeing is 0 in 20, with, yeah, there's been a few big, tiny marginal wins, but I think 0 in 20 in terms of things that could make a difference.
So adjusting this Pennsylvania case, maybe in light of the fact that they have lost so many, with the claims of not having campaign representatives present, in many cases they were. So just a little more about what's happening with that case, and where else are there cases still outstanding?
Yeah, that was a big lawsuit, and they were seeking to throw out 600,000 ballots cast in Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, as you say, because they said observers couldn't watch. What's left of the suit is this very narrow question about whether Republicans are disadvantaged because some Democratic counties allow voters to correct errors on their mail-in ballots and others don't. But the margins are too small to make a difference. Other than that, cases are still outstanding in Michigan, Arizona, Georgia, Wisconsin, Nevada. But with a big loss on Friday in a federal appeals court, the record is not looking good.
Yeah. And these are challenges that are still in a number of states that Biden won that remain. Thousands or tens of thousands of votes was the margin. Isn't it just very unlikely results in any of the lawsuits that still are outstanding would change anything, because they'd have to be in multiple states and thousands of votes.
That's exactly right. And that's why any attempt to compare this to Bush v. Gore in 2000 is dead wrong. Bush v. Gore, we were talking about a few hundred votes in one state in Florida during a recount, where it really did swing the margins and swing the election. Here, he would have to prevail in two, three, four states. And as you say, the margins often are in the tens of thousands.
Yeah. Porter, Wright, Morris, and Arthur, the law firm at the forefront, you know, working with the administration to challenge the presidential results in Pennsylvania, withdrew from a federal lawsuit from the campaign. Are law firms involved in these challenges getting heat, or, you know, maybe even scorn because they've turned out to be baseless?
Yeah, they're one of two firms that have withdrawn over pressure in the last week. And I think it's really important not to compare this to lawyers who represented Guantanamo detainees and got heat. Those folks were filing meritorious claims on behalf of unpopular clients. These are law firms who are bringing bits of evidence on Post-it notes and getting thrown out of court.
Yeah. So how long do you think this goes on?
Well, as long as Rudy Giuliani keeps wanting to file lawsuits, but you can sense that the party is moving away writ large from claims that the whole election was stolen.
Dahlia Lithwick, who writes about the courts and the law for Slate, also hosts the podcast Amicus. Dahlia, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
The results of the American election are reverberating around the world, and we've been speaking with reporters to see how it's resonating where they are. Today, we head to Brazil and Mexico. NPR's Philip Reeves joins us from Rio de Janeiro. Hey, Phil.
Hi.
And Carrie Kahn joins us from Mexico City. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Tanya.
Let's start with you. You know, despite President Trump's rhetoric against Mexico, which we'll get into in just a moment, Mexico's president has actually thanked Trump for his kindness. What's the general reaction in Mexico to the U.S. election and Biden's win?
Well, not only does he thank him for his kindness, he has not recognized Biden as the president-elect. He says, in keeping with Mexico's long tradition of non-intervention in foreign affairs, he can't recognize a winner until election authorities certify the election. And he also likes to recall how he was, quote, robbed of an election here in 2006. But you have to keep in mind that, like he said, López Obrador and Trump have a publicly good working relationship. And that's despite all of Trump's browbeating of Mexicans, tariff threats, border wall threats, all that. He and Trump are close.
Right, right. I mean, in talking about that rhetoric, I mean, Trump has repeatedly blamed Mexico for allowing drugs to be shipped into the United States by trafficking groups. He famously said Mexico should pay for the wall, which, of course, did not happen. But beyond Trump's rhetoric, what effect have Trump's policies and threats actually had on Mexico and its relationship with the United States?
I think most importantly that Mexico and the region here has had to deal with two main aspects of the Trump administration. That's his unpredictability, his volatility, and his singular focus on immigration. You know, for Mexico, he did push an overhaul of NAFTA, but it wasn't a hugely different trade agreement. Some concessions were made on strengthening labor rights in Mexico, but singularly the Trump administration has been focused on immigration. He's bullied Mexico into accepting asylum seekers to wait out their U.S. court proceedings in Mexico. He pushed Mexico to send troops to its southern and northern borders to keep migrants from getting to the U.S. And Trump has also pushed other Central American countries into immigration agreements that to accept migrants and crack down on migrant traffic. So, you know, this has been the singular focus here, and that's been mostly the relationship between the Trump administration, Mexico, and Central America.
Something else really interesting is Joe Biden's experience dealing with Mexico and the region. He has quite a bit. Talk about that and what Mexico and Central Americans can expect from a Biden presidency.
Biden is very familiar with the issues in the region. You know, he was Obama's point person for Central America, especially after in 2014, if you remember, there was a surge in unaccompanied minors that came to the southern border. So Biden was very focused on improving the economic and the social issues that are in Central America, in Mexico, that pushes the migration to the U.S. He was very focused on anti-corruption issues, especially in Guatemala and Honduras. He also will most likely focus on climate change and labor rights under the new trade pact that was signed. between Mexico and Canada and the U.S. But Biden will also have a more measured, you know, policy toward the region, not singularly focused just on immigration. And that's something that corrupt elites and leaders in this region are not going to like. Mm. But he also, you know, early on, I believe he's going to have to face increased migration out of the region. These economies, especially in Central America and Mexico, are taking a huge hit due to the pandemic. And now we have this devastating hurricane damage. We had a hurricane less than 2 weeks ago, and another one, Category 5, is headed to the same part of the region. And that's going to be a major contributor of migration to the U.S. and pretty early on in the Biden administration.
Okay, let's bring in Philip Reeves in Rio. Phil, President Trump and Brazil's President Bolsonaro have been compared to each other. They're both populists. They didn't want to wear masks during the pandemic. On the surface, it seems like there has been a better relationship between Brazil and the U.S. than there was between the U.S. and Mexico early on under President Trump. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. I mean, it's no coincidence that Bolsonaro is the only leader in South America who's yet to congratulate Biden or to recognize him as president-elect. Even Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela, who's not exactly a friend of the United States, has done so. Bolsonaro's, you know, he's never made any secret that he's a huge admirer of Trump. He considers him an ideological soulmate. Trump's baseless claims of fraud and conspiracy resonate with Bolsonaro's favorite themes that he uses to fire up his base here in Brazil, which is the, you know, very familiar stuff, that the mainstream media is all fake news and that the institutions of democracy, Congress and the judiciary, are undermining the will of the people, and that political opponents of this kind of far right populism are socialists or communists.
Trump and Bolsonaro, ideological soulmates. What a description. What does the government there expect from a Biden presidency?
Well, one thing we know, that Biden is likely to take a far harder line on the Amazon rainforest. He wants to hold Bolsonaro to account for the growing amount, the very alarming amount of destruction that's been happening there on Bolsonaro's watch. Biden made that abundantly clear in the first presidential TV debate. He talked about setting up a fund to help Brazil protect the forest, but also imposing sanctions if deforestation continues unchecked. And that infuriated Bolsonaro. He called it lamentable. He went on a rant on Twitter. We don't know, though, you know, whether Biden can get Bolsonaro to change tack. I mean, Bolsonaro's already been under a lot of pressure from Europe, from big business here in Brazil and internationally, from big guns in the media over this issue. But he hasn't budged from his central position, which is that the Amazon is a sovereign issue and that outsiders should butt out.
Where has Trump stood on this, and what effect has the Trump administration policies had on Brazil?
Well, Trump has put very little pressure on Bolsonaro of any kind, but he has fundamentally shifted Brazil's foreign policy. Brazil's traditionally been friendly to Washington, but especially when the left was in power here, somewhat aloof, not least because of the U.S.'s unhappy history of intervention in the region. Bolsonaro just changed all that, and commentators here are now saying that Bolsonaro has given Trump a lot more love than he ever got back, and that he hasn't gained all that much from the relationship in terms of, say, better trade terms, and that with Trump gone, Bolsonaro's now isolated, a far-right, tub-thumping populist sitting in a region that, if you look at Argentina, Bolivia, even Chile, seems to be tilting to the left again.
Carrie, bringing you back in here, of course, as we know, the pandemic is a huge problem, no matter who our American president is. Nearly 100,000 people have died from COVID-19 in Mexico. You kind of alluded to this when you talked about migration going to be a huge issue moving forward, the coronavirus having a big play in that. But how would you characterize the impact coronavirus is having in Mexico right now?
Well, it's devastating. Mexico just passed the 1 million mark of confirmed cases of COVID, and as you said, nearly 100,000 people have died, and that's all with very little testing in the country. Less than 2% of the population has been tested. You only get a test here in Mexico if you're seriously ill and hospitalized, so the numbers are much higher. New restrictions have just been put in place in Mexico City for the next 2 weeks because cases have spiked, and you can't really call this rise in cases a second wave because the first wave never really decreased. So the president continues to downplay the virus. He doesn't wear a mask, and his point person on on coronavirus here says testing is a waste of time, a waste of resources. So they're really depending on a vaccine coming soon, and they have an aggressive policy to try and get one. But there are no lockdowns. There are no mandatory closures. The president here values economic opening over the health situation, and due to the high informal economy here. So we're just going to have to see. It doesn't sound like there's any abating of the coronavirus situation here in the near future.
In the near future. Phil, Brazil's COVID-19 death toll is second only to the U.S., more than 160,000 deaths and 5 million infections. Those numbers are really, really horrible. Does it feel that way there?
Yes. And no, I mean, here in Rio de Janeiro, I went out to have a look around on Saturday evening. I went to the Sugarloaf Mountain, which is near where I'm sitting now. There was a big crowd in front of the beach. There was beer, there were food stalls, there was a live band. People were singing along without masks. The Brazilians very often do that. They like to join in music. And this kind of behavior really is common not only all over this city, but across Brazil. Yet if you talk to Brazilians about what the pandemic's doing to their lives, you hear a lot of very sad stories about lost income, lost jobs, their concerns for friends and relatives who've got sick. And I'm also hearing a resurgence of official concern about the stress that's being put on hospitals in some areas, and about, in particular, their fears of a second wave.
That's NPR's Philip Reeves in Rio. We've also been speaking with NPR's Carrie Kahn in Mexico City. Thanks to you both.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
Kansas City, Missouri is announcing new COVID-19 restrictions. They already have a big red warning on their website that the city is in an official state of emergency. Masks have been required indoors for months now. And last week, health officials in the Kansas City metro area even issued a regional call to action, warning that hospitals are facing serious challenges. But the response has been piecemeal. So let's bring in Quentin Lucas, mayor of Kansas City, Missouri. And Mayor Lucas, you announced the new restrictions today. What are they?
So we will have a few different steps in Kansas City, one of which is limiting capacity for a number of venues, including, importantly, entertainment venues. It turns out that folks were still having weddings, retirement parties, et cetera. And we will have a size capacity of no more than 10 people being allowed to congregate in any type of group, unless there's some special approval from the Director of Public Health. In addition to that, we'll see more closures of indoor dining and restaurant opportunities, first starting with 10 o'clock p.m. closures, and then ultimately we may review again to see if we need to fully close indoor dining, as has been seen in other parts of the Midwest. On the whole, we also are adding mask requirements at all times for everyone, including our public safety folks. We've had an outbreak in the Kansas City Police Department because mask wearing was not as common there as we would like. We're adding that consistency around the way. But there are a number of tweaks and I think really important changes to make sure that people are understanding how serious this moment is and how we have to try to stem the tide of our growing COVID case count.
Well, your opinion piece in the Kansas City Star yesterday was titled, "If Kansas City Doesn't Take COVID-19 Seriously Now, We Are All at Risk." Are you saying they aren't? I mean, what are you seeing? Are you seeing people maybe partying or not wearing masks?
You know, we continue to see a number of challenges, and some of which include that although people's hearts may be in the right place, they think that it's still important to visit some of their relatives, and we're particularly concerned with that as we approach the Thanksgiving holiday. Another thing that is particularly challenging here in Red State America is that the belief in the threat of COVID-19 is very different between the city and some of the counties that border us. And so there are not mask requirements. There are some leaders throughout our state that in some situations I feel like don't necessarily believe that COVID-19 is even a thing. And so we have continued to have more ICU bed space that is filled up by some of our outstate brethren. And we continue to try to call and implore them to look to some restrictions because right now our hospitals are getting flooded with cases that are not just from the city, but folks that are coming to primary care opportunities in Kansas City that are in areas of the state that don't have the type of health care provisions that are helpful for addressing COVID-19.
Well, just this past Friday, Johnson County, Kansas, which is, you know, kind of east of you, I think, and more rural, passed a public health order that lets restaurants and bars stay open until midnight. Gyms, too, if they close locker rooms. Attendance at churches and funerals will not be restricted. So you are, as you are saying, you're kind of fighting with this patchwork quilt of policies. And this is very close to you, where people will be, you know, going out to dinner till midnight. You've mentioned possibly down the road, closing indoor dining, you know, at a time when it's going to start getting pretty cold there. Do you think, there's, as we said, health officials have had a call to action. Do you think that that's going to soon have to include stay at home?
I think that we may get back to a point where we need to look at those sorts of orders. I mean, I'll just admit, I looked at what happened back east in the spring, and I'm scared of what we're seeing here in the middle of the country right now. Deaths are rising. It is a consistent stream. What's different for us now versus the midsummer when we had huge mask politics issues and I had a group that threatened several recalls of me and they pursued the process, et cetera. But the difference now is that everybody knows someone who has been touched by COVID-19. And a lot more people who know someone are saying, well, it wasn't as easy as one might have thought before. And I think that no matter what it is that we are doing, our goal has to be saving lives. We have given out millions of dollars to support Kansas City businesses. We will continue to try to make sure folks can stay open and survive. But at the same time, our job is to make sure that we don't have an unnecessarily high number of deaths. We don't want to see bodies stored in freezers. We don't want to actually see some of the things that if you look at the charts and you look at that incredibly increasing spike in cases, and the graphs coming our way, that Kansas City seems to be on a path for. So I will do everything in my power to make sure that people can be safe, even at times when, the state-level direction isn't quite there. I do listen to what happens in other states, and I'm very jealous in some ways of the responses they've been able to have in places like New York State or Michigan or Ohio, which is run by a Republican governor. I hope that we can get to that here, but short of that, we'll do what we can, even if that means a patchwork of local legislation in the area around us.
Clinton Lucas, mayor of Kansas City, Missouri, thank you so much. Good luck.
Thank you so much. Stay safe, everyone.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here Now.